Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of How Bette Davis Saved My Life, starring none other than the two most fabulous ladies in classic Hollywood interests, fans, none other than myself, Miss Moya, and my gorgeous and fabulous co-host, none other than Miss Georgia herself. How are you today, Georgia?
I'm doing great this beautiful December morning, Moya. How are you?
I am doing well. We've taken a little break because we had to. It was the holidays and we have our, look, we love y'all, but we have our own personal lives. Thank you very much. We ain't got time, but it's all the time. But we do try to give it to you the best that we can. And we hope that you have been enjoying our podcast. The last one was British cinema, trying to introduce you all or refamiliarize you to British cinema. I know some of you are huge Anglo-cinemaphile people. Is that a word? I don't know. I just made that up. But huge fans of British cinema. And so we did Genevieve and The Wrong Arm of the Law with Peter Sellers. And so we look forward to bringing you some more British cinema. But this time we want to switch it up per Georgia's suggestion and do some Christmas stuff because it's, like she says, December. And we have to do a Christmas movie. And so we actually found a movie. Most of the time, Georgia has not seen, like, I'm the one who has, I ain't gonna say wasted, but devoted most of her life to classic movies. And a lot of them Georgia has not seen. And so this time she got the one-upmanship on me. I had not actually seen our movie today, which is what, Georgia?
It's A Wonderful Life.
Yes, yes, yes. Si, senora. It's A Wonderful Life starring none other than, drum roll,
James Stewart. And Donna Reed and Lionel Barrymore.
Yes, yes. Three of Hollywood's stalwart, just, you know, they are Hollywood. And television, too. Television, Donna Reed. And, you know, we'll probably get into that. We all know her from the Donna Reed Show and the Barrymore from the Barrymore family. And James Stewart for just being James Stewart. So I am going to let Georgia kick this off because, like I said, I had never seen It's a Wonderful Life. And so I was shocked. I'm going to be honest with you, Georgia. So Georgia and I, we don't do a whole lot of prep before this. We do a little prep, but we try to keep it as authentic as possible. But I hadn't seen it and I had seen bits and pieces, but I had never wanted to see it because they always show the most sappiest parts of the movie. And I'm like, I don't want to see that goody two shoes, good feel good freaking Christmas movie. And look, disclaimer, I'm not a huge Christmas person. I'm not exactly the Grinch. I'm Grinch light. So I'm like a lighter version. I'm like, well, he's booger green, so I'm like lime green Grinch. So I'm like a lighter version of the Grinch. So, you know, I'm not a huge Christmas person. But, Georgia, I was pleasantly surprised. So start us off about our movie.
Sure thing. Well, you know, to me, I think this movie is a masterpiece. And I think it's one of the greatest movies ever made. And I'm going to start out with what the basic premise is. I'm not going to give too much away. Okay. Yes, Moya, sometimes this movie, like, it's very joyous and, you know, it's about small town America. But the thing is it does have its dark, there are dark moments to this movie. It can be dark. But the thing is what you have is the central character played by James Stewart. He's George Bailey and he's a good-hearted man and he wants to leave Bedford Falls, and he wants to travel the world, go to college, and he wants to build buildings and bridges and what have you. But, like what happens to all of us, life gets in the way, and through circumstances beyond his control, he has to forego each one of his dreams and goals and aspirations to always help other people and not himself. So, George is on the very brink of suicide when a very unlikely looking angel appears on the scene and proceeds to show him what the town and everyone's life would be like if he had never been born.
That's deep.
Yes, it's very deep. And so, I mean, this movie, to me, it has it all. It's got values and ideals. It has a miracle, an angel. It has the power of a praying family. To me, this movie is near life-changing, because if you have not seen this movie, I think, I know this sounds very arrogant and pompous of me to say it, but I'm going to say it. If you haven't seen this movie, I think you're deprived.
Yeah.
And I think that this movie will make you examine your life and other people's lives in a whole different way after you see this movie.
Right.
And so I'm just going to start out by saying it's one of the most meaningful movies because it has a message that transcends through time. It is a timeless movie. It does hold up well. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the very few movies that I can watch over and over again.
Yes.
But
yes.
Surprisingly, this movie was not a box office hit.
Right.
It was.
No, you're right. It wasn't.
But anyway, I just want to say this movie was, I have to give props. It was adapted from a short story, The Greatest Gift, by Philip Van Doren, published in 1943. But he couldn't sell the story. So what he finally did was he took the movie he took the story, he made it into a little pamphlet, and then he distributed it at Christmas time to about 200 people.
Mm.
And the movie sat on the shelf for a while before it was thought about being made. But Capra, who had directed Jimmy Stewart before in Mr. Deeds Goes to Town and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, mm-hmm. really wanted James Stewart to play this role. And in fact, you know, he had just come out of World War II, and James right. Stewart did not want to take on this role because it was just too soon after the war to take on a role like this. But mm-hmm. believe it or not, Lionel Barrymore convinced him to take on this lead role because they were actually considering Cary Grant as their first choice to play George Bailey.
Wow. And you know, you and I discussed that a little earlier, and I was like, you know, I'm nothing against Cary Grant whatsoever, but it was James Stewart's role. And sorry, Cary Grant fans. Cary Grant, just a little sidebar, I don't think he was given enough opportunities to show the depth of his acting, because I think he was a really good actor. But I can't see anybody but James Stewart. He just had maybe just that little bit more of what you need to take it over the top. I'm not saying Cary Grant wouldn't have done a good job, but Jimmy Stewart is George Bailey. Like, I can't see anyone else doing it. Maybe if James Stewart just was not going to do it, maybe Cary Grant, but he is George Bailey.
He does epitomize that role. I can't imagine anybody else in it. And this is Donna Reed's very first starring role, and they had actually wanted to cast other people. The role was also offered to Ginger Rogers, and she turned it down. She said it was too bland. And the other people who were considered for the role were his other co-stars. There was Jean Arthur, and there was also Olivia de Havilland.
Now,
I thought that the casting...
Say it again. I'm sorry. We had a little bad audio. Why did Ginger Rogers turn it down? Say it again.
Ginger Rogers turned it down because she felt the role was just too bland.
Okay.
And later on, she said in her autobiography, oh, yeah, I got that right, huh?
Shoulda, woulda, coulda.
Yeah.
Right. But Donna Reed, she was superb. And I put that in my notes because I don't really know a whole bunch about her. I know she won an Oscar from Here to Eternity. She was wonderful in that, but unfortunately,
yes.
You know, they didn't know what to do with her after that because she had that baby face, angel face. But when she played from Here to Eternity, that prostitute, that role, I think they got Hollywood got scared of her because she was like a little. Volcano that they had not, you know, she was Mount Vesuvius and they weren't expecting that. And they didn't know, you know, you can't put her back into those cutesy roles after that because she was just too hot to try.
Oh, yeah. She was a powerhouse. You're right. She had such range.
Right.
She was so great. But, you know, this movie, it has some interesting things about some of the scenes in it.
Okay.
Do you remember the scene where George, the young boy George, is at the pharmacy, mm-hmm. and Mr. Gower, mm-hmm. he plays the druggist. He hits him in the head. Well, you know, he does it in the actual filming of that scene. He's hitting him in the head for real. He actually made his ear bleed and caused him to cry. And the actor who played Gower hugged him afterward. But that is real.
Gosh.
Really bled during the film. Yes.
Oh my gosh, that's horrible.
So many things about the, it's horrible, isn't it? Yeah. And one of the things about this is, one of my favorite scenes in this movie is when, you know, because he's like deaf in that one ear, mm-hmm. and little Mary, she leans over to him at that countertop.
Oh.
And what she whispers.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Ear. Oh, my God.
Georgia, like, that's one of the few clips I'd ever seen of the movie. And I thought it was so cute and funny, but then I was like, I don't want to, because that's one of the scenes that made me, that turned me off from like, I was like, oh, that's so cutesy. I don't want to see
it. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Right, it was so cute.
Little girl, to show you the depth, she had a crush on him. She was in love with him as a little girl.
I know. But that look, in that really same something. In that same scene, though, with Violet, like right before that scene, the other little girl, the little blonde haired girl, Violet, and so Mary, you know, Violet was a huge flirt, a notorious flirt, even as a little girl. So, of course, she, you know, flaunted herself in front of George Bailey, Georgie. And Mary says, oh, Violet, she says, I like George. And so Mary says, oh, Violet, you like all the boys. And she was like, yes. And so, you know, who could identify with that? I was like, yeah, and yeah. especially if the boys like you, little girl. Like, what's the problem? So that movie, and you know, then they go on to show them later on as adults and slight rivals, and this movie has a lot.
Well, I was also going to point out some trivia about the telephone scene, you know, with George and Mary. You know, he goes over to her house.
Yes, I love that scene.
Okay, and that scene where, you know, that friend Sam Wainwright is on the phone, right. And they're both like together on the phone,
right?
And that crazy mother, she's are you listening? And mother hangs up the phone, and goes, "No, I'm not." But anyway, that scene is charged with such silent yet powerful emotion.
Yes,
when they both realize their undeniable feelings for each other. But you know, that scene was done in just one take.
No way.
I know. It's so powerful. But yes, they did it in one take. But I have to tell you, well, I'm going to circle back to that.
Okay.
But one of the things about this movie is that it lost its copyright protection due to a clerical error.
Oh,
so this movie is now in the public domain, but nobody got royalties from it after that happened. I have to ask people, please, please do one thing for me. Do not see the colorized version.
Don't
see the colorized. But I have to tell you, this film, I mean, it has, for some people, it is a family tradition and a ritual. In my family, it has tremendous meaning. My cousin Joey is always so deeply moved by it that she cries her heart out every time.
Aww.
And my cousin Harry, he showed this movie to his high school history class so they would understand what a run on the bank is.
Right.
My aunt Amy Jo, and like many families like mine, she is the George Bailey of our family.
Mm-hmm.
She is that person. She is the one that comes and helps when, you know, there's no help from anywhere else. She's the one. And then my sweetheart, Chip when he learned a few years ago that I had not seen this movie. And it, from its start to its entirety, all the way from start to finish, he wanted to watch it with me because he knew I would feel all the feels and experience the height and the breadth and the emotional range and the darkness and the wonder and the exulting joyness of it. And yes, when I watched it again a few days ago, I had tears streaming down my face.
So what part makes you cry?
The end?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's like, he wants, I could feel his like wanting to live again. And then very end, what all the friends do, mm-hmm. what they do, it's so unexpected, the thing that they do.
Right.
And they wanted to end the movie with the song Ode to Joy, but they did it with Auld Lang Syne instead. And I'm glad they chose Auld Lang Syne because it would have been a little too, it wouldn't have hit the right note. But mm-hmm. it's just the fact that all the lines and the messages in it, you know, all of it just wrapped up so beautifully. His brother said, you know, George Bailey, you were the richest man in town.
Mm-hmm.
And when he opened up the book that Clarence the Angel had left him and what he wrote in there, and no man is poor who has friends.
Right.
There's so many great lines, but let me tell you, the one that makes me laugh my head off every time, I don't know why, but you know when the mother says, there's a scene where she's listening in and she says, what does that Bailey boy want? And then Mary says, he's making violent love yes. to me, mother.
Yes.
That cracks me up. I go into hysterics every time I hear that line.
Yeah, that was hilarious. Yeah, I was shocked that she said that and, you know, got away with that. Because, you know, like that was almost like cussing, I guess, back then, you know, to say something like that. what I liked about...
Making love meant something different back then, Moya. Making love meant to, like, just court somebody or to, that's what making love meant to them. To
right.
us, making love means have sex, you know?
Yeah, but no, I got that part. It was just the fact that she said it loudly and just said it, period. You know, that, you know, just to say it out loud like that and be so bold and defiant. And even though she was, you know, I just found it hilarious that she even said it. And I guess her mom was used to her, but it was good character. Character building, character stories, you know, for the storyline to show that this girl was tenacious, and you'll see it more in the as the story unfolds how tenacious Mary was, and really a strong personality. And so for her to say that, you know, and in hindsight looking at it, this shouldn't be any surprise because that's who Mary was. She was really forward thinking, you know. And because when her and, you know, because she really drove that relationship, like she meant she was going to get her man, and she played him like a fiddle. And if he wanted to leave, she wasn't going to run behind him. I loved it. And so, you know, I was taking notes, Georgia, and back to that scene, you said when they're on the phone and, it, you know, the mom was listening in, and Wainwright was calling in. That was so passionate and erotic. Without being filthy yes. or vulgar. And I put that in my notes and I said, you don't see that nowadays unless you look at no offense to y'all Hallmark and Lifetime people. I mean, that's not my jam. But, you know, sometimes, you know, those movies will have just a glimmer of that. But kudos to great acting and writing and directing. Because they didn't, you know, start slobbering over each other or making goo-goo eyes. It was just perfect. And I felt the eroticism and the passion in the game without being, you know, just disgusting, just absolutely disgusting with it. But that's when people really acted and people really invested in the character and the storylines of movies. And I think that's what makes this movie just excellent.
You described that scene so perfectly, Moya. I didn't quite have the words, but you nailed it. I want to thank you for that. You did it so well. You know, do you have any like favorite lines in that movie that kind of really like stood out to you?
I didn't write any down, but I just documented some scenes. So like you said, we don't want to spoil it. And probably ever, I probably was the last person on earth who hadn't seen It's a Wonderful Life. So I'm probably not spoiling it for anybody. But
I don't know,
but just certain scenes. So you know, Georgia kind of put the time frame. So it's like right after World War One and ironically the Spanish flu. It takes the pharmacist, Mr. Gower's son. So it kind of starts in that time frame, and then it goes on, like Georgia said, on the World War II. But Lionel Barrymore, Mr. Potter, okay, yes, I can say he was the villain. And let me just say this, and I know y'all can come for me on Facebook. I don't care. I love commentary. I'm not going to cancel anybody. I don't do that. I don't play them games. So I'm gonna ask you, George, and you can give me the business if you want to. Well, I'm a huge Lionel Barrymore fan, and so I love the politics and the business, you know, politics and business in real life, but the politics and business in the movie. Like I said, I really feel robbed that I haven't seen this movie, you know, several times, because thinking it was just some sappy movie. But you know how Mr. Potter. Well, they all agreed the Baileys were horrible businessmen, and there were several things that happened with Uncle Billy that confirms that. But you know, Mr. Potter, Lionel Barrymore, like I said, I'm a huge fan. How he was right, you know, he and with the people, he could care less. They want to say he was heartless, and you know, you could try to say he's corporate America and all. But you can't run a business on emotions. So I think both camps were right. George Bailey saying, hey, these are our people. These are our friends and neighbors. We need to try to support them. And I think Potter was right to a certain extent. Well, you can't take that to the bank. You can't eat feelings and emotions. You know, so I think Potter was guilty of, amongst other things, I don't want to give it away, what he did that was so egregious that caused poor George Bailey to go over the edge. But his failure to recognize the culture and connect with the culture and the community for whatever reason. So if there was a sequel to this movie, Georgia, I would love the Potter story. And it kind of touched on Mr. Potter a little bit, his background. But don't you think a sequel to this about why the hell Mr. Potter was the devil? Why he had a skull on his desk, which I loved. He was horrible, and Barrymore played, and you know, I love, he can always play a villain, but don't you think there would be a good sequel, Mr. Potter, What Happened to Mr. Potter, or some foolishness like that? We could call it something. Don't you think that?
It would have to be really, really well written.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And, you know, the thing is, it's like, yeah, what amazes me is I'm waiting in this movie, and I'll let you people who may not have watched it yet, wait and see what happens. Mr. Potter, he does something really
evil,
really egregious,
evil, just evil.
And you'll see what happens if he gets away with it or if he doesn't get away with it. You're gonna see. But yeah, but you know, in answer to your question, Moya, I would, in a way, when you ask me that question, I think of the movies that were written by Charles Dickens, you know.
Yes, 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 yes.
You know, the Christmas stories, you know, where you have Ebenezer Scrooge and the way he is about it, you know,
right,
him having a man that makes me think so much of him in this role. For some reason I keep drawing parallels. I keep thinking of that.
It was.
So, but you know, that would be interesting to see what makes this guy tick and what he does and why he's this way.
Right.
What happened to him.
Right.
And everything. I mean, you do, because, you know, had George not been born, the town would have been named after him. It would have been Pottersville.
Right. And so, the movie talks about that.
And it's like a den of iniquity. I mean, you go through the streets, you see the contracts. You know how it's like every town USA, you know, it's like mom and pop store. And then without George in it, you go and it's like, vice. It's like,
yeah, it was.
It's like, you go through there and you go,
It was Bourbon Street. It was Bourbon Street. And for those of you who can't tell, I have a slight accent, apparently, from New Orleans, Louisiana. We have an accent all the time, whatevs. But yeah, I was like, oh man, that's Bourbon Street freaking every night, especially Saturday and said The Weeknd. I was like, this place looks very familiar to me. And what I laughed at, so when they showed after, you know, the part where George had he not been born, so they go into the little local watering hole, and it's somebody else has taken it over. It's now Nix's. It's now no longer Martini's. And right. The first scene they show is this Fats Waller, one of these great jazz legends, a Fats Waller type dude, big fat black guy sitting on a panel playing the piano. And so I laughed. I said, oh, now that's when they want to start showing the black people when it's Vice time. I just started laughing at that. and I'm being facetious because their maid, Annie, was black. And let me just talk about that. And they did show a few black people in the background, and especially when he started, there was some black people in the background laughing at him when he was trying to go for a walk with Violet. But anyway, I have to say, the way Annie was portrayed in this movie, which, and I hate to use the word dignity, but it was so non-traditional. She wasn't Yazza and you know, like an idiot and can't talk. She was a part of the family. She was respected. And at the end, you know, she has another part, and the lady who played her, Lillian Randolph, she became Beulah the maid after, I think she was after Hattie McDaniel left the role. And so she was one of the first black TV film stars. And I know her from my favorite show in the whole world, Sanford and Son. She's on that episode where Lamont tries to get married. Her and Fred have the most funniest exchange. It was before Aunt Esther got on there. But anyway, Lillian Randolph. But I was like, kudos to this movie. And they had a few little, like some people with some, oh, they racist. Yeah. Whatever, man. That's how people talk back then. People still talk like that. Now they just don't do it openly. But ultimately, this movie respected people. It was a diverse cast. People, oh, diversity. It was a diverse cast. And it was very respectful of everyone in that film, especially the women. Like we said, his mother, Beulah Bondi, the great Beulah Bondi. Donna Reed, she was her own person, you know, and she was the backbone of that family. And one last thing I want to say to George about that, and yeah, I'm getting political. It really showed how the father was the leader of the family. And if you have a good man, and good to the point where as he is trying to do the right thing and be the leader, how he is a leader, how he's missed, how he's needed, and how the wife, even though she was her own person, they were a team. George and Mary were with the term power couple without throwing their weight around. And they were beloved. And I said, and it really just showed the stresses that men had and men, a real men who want to be real fathers have when they try to go out in that world and fight that world fight for their family. So, and without making him be ridiculous or a caricature, this movie was so real, it was ridiculous.
Wow, what great insights, Moya. You are so, you really brought these things out to me. That is all true, you know, and he wanted to do, you know, to pay honor to his father and respect the way his father tried to run it. But he was still very much his own man. And right. Yes, and all the pressures and things that he brought to bear, because it was more than just the money. It was these people.
Right.
When Mr. Potter had these slums that people could live in, where people could get the money, and he explains it, and then go and have build a house that for their family.
Right.
Their families could have, that's the American dream. Everybody wants a home. And I thought it was so beautiful that he helped everybody else realize their dream.
Yes.
And yes, you are so right. Donna Reed, God, she was a wonderful partner.
Yes.
And I just loved her character
so
much. And the little scenes that she had and the way she was. Mm-hmm. And she would see that things would, he would be angry, but she would know there was something that caused him to be there. Something was eating at him.
Right.
There was a reason for him to be act all like,
exactly,
you know, angry and all that. She knew that something was going on with him.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
It was. But one of the things that I loved, I thought that was so cute, you know, that money that they were supposed to have used for their honeymoon.
Yes.
When there was a rep bank. And then afterwards that evening on their wedding night, doesn't she make the most out of a situation? That old home.
Oh, that old haunted mansion they moved into.
Yes. And she puts up all of what she does, the way she, I want people to watch.
Yes.
What she does to that home to make it look like it's a way, like it's a vacation, what she does to the home and how cute it is, the way she does the dinner. And then I thought it was so sweet with the friends, what the two friends do to give them like a nice little honeymoon send off. It's very heartwarming, but it just shows how resourceful she was and how she wanted to give him something that would be just fun and meaningful to him. What a sweet wedding night present that was. I just thought that was such a darling kind of a thing.
I will say this, you know, our show is called, How Bette Davis Saved My Life, Life Lessons from Classic Hollywood. That's the full title. And the life lesson is, I mean, there's so many in this movie. It's pregnant with it. But I will say this, ladies, and again, if you're a feminist, a feminazi, put your fingers in your ears. If you want to know how to be a good wife, and how to support your husband, to a good man, not an idiot, not a clown. Why are you marrying a buffoon? Is beyond me. You need to check yourself and ask yourself that. But if you married a decent guy who's trying to do the right thing, look at this movie. Look how Donna Reed works with James Stewart, you know, through the ups and downs, and supports him because she knows to support him is to support herself. This is how you do it, ladies. This is how you look at how she gets the man, how she supports the man, how she keeps the man. This is how you do it. And fellas, look at this guy. This is how you choose a wife. You know, don't get somebody, hopefully you know, a lot of people know, those don't be swiping left. You know, try to find somebody you know somewhat and you could get some intelligence on, and ladies, you do the same. And this is how you roll. And then you really see character when the chips are down. And the chips were very much so down in this movie. And this movie had several different acts and scenes. And, you know, the movie could have ended at several points, but it kept going. It had, just perfect movie. It lost, we're going to wrap up in a minute, but it lost to the Razor's Edge. We did that Razor's Edge on our podcast. I believe it's our third episode. Go check out our episode on that, but it lost the Oscar. I'm sorry, it lost the Oscar to The Best Years of Our Life. I'm sorry.
Yes.
But Razor's Edge was in contention. But we did do the Razor's Edge, like I said. Jimmy Stewart lost to Frederick March, one of my favorite actors of all time. But he earned it. Unfortunately, Donna Reed was not nominated. That is a travesty. That is absolutely an outrage. But maybe couple of years later, she got the Oscar for that. And one last thing, Georgia, before we wrap up, I don't know why I wrote this note, but I put George Bailey versus Ned Merrill from The Swimmer. So and guys, we did The Swimmer. I'm sorry, I don't know what episode it is, but we did The Swimmer. Go look it up in our catalog. Those dads and husband, let's compare those two. So you want to see what not to get versus what you need to be, ladies, what you need to be looking at, okay? And so I'm going to stop it right there. George, I'm going to leave you with the last word.
Thank you. And Moya, I just wanted to say, you know, this movie is, if you want to see something that's inspiring, this is was voted the number one most inspiring film of all time.
Oh, wow.
AFC's 100 Years, 100 Cheers. Also in 1990, the U.S. Library of Congress voted this movie culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant, and it was selected for preservation by our U.S. Library of Congress. So I just wanted to say, if you want to get into the Christmas spirit, this has been a rough year for everybody, and see something that will stay with you and give this Christmas meaning, I invite you with all my heart to see this movie, because you are in for something that will bring you such deep, soul-filling satisfaction like it has to me and my family.
Oh, yes. I look forward to looking at it again. There's a lot of great cameos by
future stars Gloria Graham and the great Ward Bond and Sheldon Leonard, who produced, went on to produce The Andy Griffith Show. Yeah. So a lot of power, yes, powerhouse Thomas Mitchell, a lot of from Gone with the Wind, a lot of powerhouse acting. So guys, we're done. Please check it out. Look us up on Facebook. How Bette Davis Saved My Life. Life Lessons from Classic Hollywood. We are now on iHeartRadio. Yay! Ooh. Yay! So check us out on there. Have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, and all that good stuff. And we will see you the next time with another great movie that you hopefully can glean some life lessons from. For How Bette Davis Saved My Life, I'm Moya. And you are, ma'am.
I'm Georgia.
Have a good one. And Georgia, I'm going to change it up a little bit. I'm going to take the Godfather of Soul and let him take us out for Christmas. This is Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. This is one of our Christmas traditions, playing soulful Christmas music. You guys have a great one.
Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Hitch up your reindeer, go straight to the ghetto.